So we are recording the audio. It'll go up with the tonight's deck and the contents of the chat window later on this evening. If you have any comments or questions, I'm going to mute all right now. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. And so if you have any comments, feel free to either use the chat window or unmute yourself and speak up audibly. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And given that we've got lots of slide material to go through tonight, I will turn it right over to Alan. Take it away, Alan.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. And as you say, we'll get right into it. We're starting off with a few shares. I just remind everybody, if you have Android apps or Windows programs that you find interesting that you think other people would enjoy, then please send us some information and we'll slot you in. So we're starting off tonight with a couple of apps from Tom on Wi-Fi systems.
And Tom is with us. There we go.
Here I am. Okay. I have a couple of apps, but I want to actually deprecate one of them. But this one I do like, Wi-Fi Analyzer. You can get analogs of this for your Windows laptop or computer as well. But it shows the Wi-Fi channel usage around your phone. And you can switch between bands. Here it's set at 2.4G, but it also does the 5G. And it's good for picking channels for your router and moving your access point for best operation. In other words, you can check the quality of your signal with your phone and see what other competitors there are. In this case, let's see, it's hard to see. I think the blue one is mine because home is not mine. So the blue one is mine, and I have it set to less. I don't know that this is to me or from some other display, but you can see where the channels are. And by the way, the latest channels for Wi-Fi range anywhere from actually not just one channel, but over two or even four channels. So you can see that channel one at the bottom, those are the channel listings, and they show the distance between them. And you can see the channel one overlaps into two and three. And the same thing with the others, because these are spread spectrum. So they use the entire spectrum. And of course, you can have interference. But the more area you have without overlap, the better signal you will have. So I suggest that if you're having any problems anywhere in your house or apartment, that you check around with your phone and see where the problems are and what the best channel is. And you can usually set the channel by logging into your router. By the way, you should change the admin name and password on your router, and then set the channel for the Wi-Fi to use. Sometimes some routers will automatically select a channel, but I haven't found that they choose the channels that are best according to the Wi-Fi analyzer. Any questions?
I don't see anything in the chat.
So can we move to 111?
Actually, I want to. Can I share my screen?
Yes, you can.
Yep.
Okay, so let's see. Zoom meeting and share screen. And yes, I want to stop. And this is a screen I want to share. Okay. Can you see that?
Yep.
So this is a screenshot from my phone. And in the settings in network and internet, you can choose your Wi-Fi and your mobile network and so on. And hotspot and tethering and data saving and VPN. But the other thing you can choose down here is your private DNS. And the quad one that I was suggesting before will give you fast DNS that's private, at least from your ISP, unless they do some snooping. But if you really want private DNS that is secured by using, what is it called, SCLS encryption, you can specify DNS not quad9.net. There are a variety of DNS providers, and some of them, on particular quad9.net, which is a site that's run by IBM and some other nice people as a service to the internet. And it does kind of light filtering so that it gets rid of all the malicious websites that are malicious domain names that you might otherwise access. And this is what I use on my phone, and for that matter, I use it on my computer as well. And you can just specify it down here, dns.quad9.net. You don't need any particular app or anything, and this is Android 10. I presume it's there in other versions of Android. I don't know what when they started allowing private DNS. But this DNS accesses the DNS here. It doesn't use the regular DNS IP packets. It uses TLS encoded stuff going directly here. You can also, by the way, you can set up most browsers to use the private DNS and set it up here using dns.quad9.net. And this is what I suggest and what I use, and it's just another layer of protection, in this case against domain names that are malicious and that will then direct you to an IP, which is a computer which is having malicious content that you probably don't want. Are there any questions?
And nothing in the chat.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Tom. So I'm just switch back to my screen. And so we now should be sharing my screen. And
yep.
I just note that we also had some input from Stuart Bruce. And he says it's been a while since he chipped in, so he's going to share a few apps. And I selected one for this week because it's kind of a security type thing which follows on from what Tom had. So, Stuart, if you want to talk to this one.
Okay, so I'm only allowed to speak to one thing a week, I see. So, following the release of the Apple AirTags, there were interesting news reports of people being stalked by other people placing AirTags in their pockets, bags, wheel wells of their cars, baby strollers, whatever, you know. And Apple decided to release a little app for Android to allow people to see if they could find an AirTag in their vicinity. I thought that's kind of cool, so I went and looked on the Play Store for it. And interestingly, most of the reviews were sort of negative. The main reason being everybody was pissed that they had to actually turn the thing on themselves. And it wouldn't just always work by itself. Well, it's a scanner and it's using Bluetooth and it's probably a battery drainer and possibly intrusive and whatever. I tried it and yeah, it works. It's got to be turned on by itself and it scans for a couple of minutes and I haven't found any AirTags in my vicinity yet. So obviously nobody cares about me. But, you know, I keep trying. Someday I'm going to find somebody that's using an AirTag somewhere. And if I'm lucky, maybe this app will set off their AirTag with an alarm. I don't know. Anyway, the only caveat I can see is that it uses Bluetooth. And when it finishes its scan, it asks you if you want to continue scanning or not, and you can either continue scanning or close the app. If you close the app, it does not shut off the Bluetooth radio on your phone. So you'll have to remember to do that manually. But if you want to play with this, whenever you think of trying to annoy people with Apple stuff, as long as you remember to shut off your Bluetooth when you're finished, you probably will have some fun.
I'm glad to see that it doesn't automatically shut off the Bluetooth, because I use the Bluetooth on my Android phone for other purposes. I wouldn't want it shut off. I have it connect to my Garmin watch, and so it sends notifications from emails and things like that. So I don't think it would be a good thing for it to shut off the Bluetooth automatically.
Fair point, but there's no setting for a choice in the Mac,
okay.
Whether you're using Bluetooth or not.
Okay.
So if you're not using Bluetooth regularly and don't want to use it regularly, you have to remember to power it down. But other than that, it's a cool little thing that looks like a World War II submarine sonar scanner. And you can walk around with your phone going, ding, ding.
This is comparable to the tiles that you can buy that are powered by little lithium-ion button cells. But the advantage of AirTag is that it's built into the Apple operating system. So everywhere that there are iPhones, the AirTag will be detected, and the GPS from the iPhone will be sent back to you from that iPhone. So it's much wider than using Tile. I use Tile. I have one under my bicycle seat, so in case my bicycle gets stolen. They are quite good to be able to tag things that you want to know the location of. And of course, for people who are stalking other people, you could put it under a car or under a car seat or other places and stalk people that way and know where their particular vehicle is or their purse or wherever else you've hidden it. So that's why there's a lot of people up in arms about it, because
If I could reinterject, you want to, if you go looking for this, you want to make sure it's from Apple, because there's already false apps by third-party people trying to claim the same thing. So make sure, if you want it, make sure there's a from Apple logo in the or use the link here the slide.
Yeah, I pasted that into the chat as well.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. Well, we will have more from you, and it may not necessarily be just one slide next time. Okay, moving along. Chris has got a number of small shares for us.
Yeah, maybe this should have come out last week, but Data Privacy Day was January 28th, as it is every year. I've included a link to the Wikipedia page on it, talking a little bit about it. And Sophos's Naked Security blog site had a very good post that they put up the other day, some simple tips to help you be more data private in your dealings. And so there's some major categories there of five different things that they highlight. And the link to that, those two links are now in the chat window. So I encourage everybody to consider data privacy. Okay, this one was an interesting one I came across the other day, a very large power bank. And so if you think that your power bank that you have for charging up USB devices, phones and cameras and just about anything else that can link out to USB for charging, if you have a 20,000 milliamp hour or 30,000 milliamp hour, you think that's big. Well, how about a 27 million milliamp hour portable power bank? They say it can charge 5,000 phones, and it can actually charge 60 devices simultaneously. There's that many outlets on it. And here's a picture of it, and you can see it is portable. It's on wheels. And this guy here, he has it. This is the designer of it and the builder. And he actually went out fishing, and he had his TV with him and his washing machine so that he could wash his clothes at the same time. So kind of interesting. It's a fun video to watch, and it shows the actual construction of this USB power bank. And the link on that I will paste into the chat as well. Just give me half a second. And that's in the link now as well. Okay, the next one just came out today. I think it was just released today. I got the update today. Everybody who knows me at all knows that I'm a big fan of the Windows Power Toys. And so they're a great series of utilities that have come out. I think they're up to 13, I guess a dozen now that they have. And a new version came out, 0.55.0, and one of the enhancements was to one of the Power Toys mouse pointer crosshairs. And everybody who knows me knows that I'm a big fan of this, especially when I'm presenting over a video conference, and to be able to have people see where my mouse pointer is at any point in time. This is another possibility. The idea actually came out of the accessibility group at Microsoft, and they actually did a lot of the coding for it. And it goes beyond the idea of just being able to have other people see your cursor. Because it came out of the accessibility group, I read up a little bit on it, and it turns out that people who have vision issues, like not totally blind, but low vision or tunnel vision, they actually say that this is actually fantastic utility to allow them to use their own computers to see where the mouse is at any point in time. Once it's installed, if you go into the settings, there are lots of capabilities, so you can turn it on or off as you see fit. The next one, the activation shortcut. By default, it's Control-Alt-P, but you can alter that to anything you want. It has to include either Windows, Control, or Alt, or Shift keys, and then you can also have another modifier with it, like a letter P. Under the appearance and behavior, you can change the color of it. You can change the opacity of it. You can have a circle at the radius of the crosshairs. You can change the size of that. Various things like that. So what I'd like to do now is just give a really brief overview of it. So I'm going to share my screen. And there we go. And now here's an example. If I get right, there we go. Okay, so I'm doing some photo editing, and just move around some controls here. So if I'm doing this and I want people to see that I'm adjusting, say, a slider over here, exposure, you might say, oh, where's the cursor? You know, I don't see it. So if I just do the default of Control-Alt-P, you now see that I have crosshairs, and you can see where my cursor is at any point in time is at the crosshairs of that. So if I go over and I'm adjusting, say, the exposure slider, you know, you can see as I drag it around the effect of that on the photo editing. As I said, you can change the color. The opacity, when I first brought it up, if you look over here where it says, you know, the just to the right of the crosshairs, manual AI match AI auto, the default was like completely opaque, and so it would block out anything that was underneath it. But I found that just dropping down the opacity still allowed that to show up, but showed the background through it so that I didn't obliterate parts of the screen. So yet another utility. I still actually prefer, if I turn this one off, I can actually run them at the same time. I still actually prefer when I'm teaching or demoing things to use Cursor Highlighter, which allows a lot of controls. And the control I like the most is where I have it a semi-opaque circle, and I can adjust the size of that circle so I can see what I'm doing on the screen as well. But yet another capability that you can have. And so I encourage people to try out the Power Toys. And certainly if you have low vision friends or you have low vision, you might find that this allows you to more easily track where your mouse cursor is. And that's it. So I will stop the share and turn it back over to Alan.
And pick up the share again. Okay, I think we're there.
Yep.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Some good tips there. Okay, so I just have a few slides on this idea of moving from Windows to Linux. And last week we spent quite a bit of time looking at how to do a live USB or a live DVD to check it out. And I suggested that you should do that before you even think of installing anything. But what happens if you decide that you do want to install it? And you remember that when you run the live USB, you get these icons on the screen, and one of them says install Linux, in my case, Linux Mint. So we're going to install Linux on the hard drive. Typically, what I would suggest, anybody who's new to Linux, do it in dual boot format. So install Linux, but install it side by side with the existing Windows installation. And to do that, you basically have to create a second partition. But typically, the installer will take care of that for you. However, before you do anything like this, I highly, highly, highly recommend that you make a disk image of your system. And if you screw something up and everything goes south, if you have a complete disk image, it's really easy and really quick to restore everything back to where you started. And if you don't do that, you're going to be groveling around trying to find installation CDs, and you're going to spend a lot of time rebuilding your system. So a disk image is a really good idea if you're going to play with Linux on your hard drive. There are tons of installation guides, so I don't have to go through it slide by slide, step by step, to tell you how to install it. If you're interested in Linux Mint, for example, they have a really good step-by-step pictorial guide, takes you through every step in the process, and really is very easy, just like installing Windows, basically. So you get slides like this where you have to decide whether you want to do certain things. Here there's a checkbox, which I've actually checked, whether you want to install third-party software or not. So typically, if you have a graphics card or some exotic Wi-Fi hardware, then you may want to install the manufacturer's software to run that rather than relying on open source drivers, for example. And typically, if you don't know the answer to the questions, you can basically check it and say, yes, I want to do this. It'll probably work out just fine. One of the things you don't want to do, though, is accept this recommendation. And quite often, when you get to this stage in the installation process, it will give you the choice to erase the disk and install Linux. Now, if you leave this default in place and just say continue, you will remove Windows. It will blow away everything on your disk. You'll lose Windows. You'll lose your data files. You'll lose everything because it will start fresh with a brand new disk, and all you will end up with is Linux. So really do not accept this. What you want to do is change the option to something like this. Hopefully you have the install Linux alongside Windows. So this is the dual boot, dual partition type installation. Now, as I say here, the installer will create the disk partition. So if you're lucky, and typically if you're doing a brand new install on a Windows-only installation, the installer will decide for you how it's going to split up the hard drive. So it's going to leave a great big partition on the left here, which will be your Windows partition, and it will create what it decides is a reasonable size for Linux. And if you don't know what you really want to do here, then just leave it as the default. 25 gig for a Linux install is actually plenty. It's really, really quite big. However, if you know what you're doing and you think you want more than that, then or less than that, whatever, you can actually drag this divider left and right and either increase or decrease the partitions as you wish. So if you end up with that situation, that's really easy. The second option is that you'll get this kind of thing where it says, I don't want to erase the disk. I don't want to encrypt. I don't want a logical volume. The only option is to do something else, which is kind of scary. I mean, who knows what something else means? But what it says is that you can create partitions yourself. And then you end up with a window like this one right here, where it's a bit like a partition. It's a partition editor. So you have to split out some free space and then build a root partition, maybe give some space for some swap space. And it's a bit complicated. So if you end up in this kind of situation, I really recommend going to my blog, Linux North, and looking at the tips section, where there's a whole section on manual partitioning, and it goes through this in step-by-step, easy-to-follow detail, and it will show you exactly how to partition your drive and create the relevant partitions for Linux. But as I say, hopefully you'll end up with the other one where you can just choose the default partition that the installer chooses for you. And then again, you'll get some questions which may seem a bit odd. It wants to know where you are, and it thinks you're in New York. It really doesn't care where you are. What it's really trying to find out is, what time zone are you in? So you could change this to, say, Toronto, and all it means is you're in this Eastern Standard Time when it sets up the time and date specifications. The one that you do want to pay attention to is this slide, where you actually set up the configuration. So you can give it any name that you want. You can give it any computer name that you want. It will select something based on your make and model, but you can change that to whatever you want. And then you can give it a user ID and a password. One trick here, the user ID, if it's still as it was, you have to have a lowercase username. Anybody who remembers me doing a live demo of how to install Linux on one of the club meetings, I was actually doing it for my buddy John, and I picked the username John, capital J-O-H-N. And then later on, I found I couldn't log in, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't log in. Well, I couldn't log in because I put capital J-O-H-N, and the installer said, well, you can't have that. You have to have lowercase J. So it was lowercase J-O-H-N, and I didn't notice. So when I tried to log in with my capital J, I couldn't log in. And then it took me a while afterwards, after the meeting, to figure out what the problem was. You don't actually have to have a username and a password, but it's good practice to do that. It's like having an admin account in Windows. So I choose Toaster. One of my friends always used to complain that computers should be like toasters. You plug them in and they work. And I always argued that, well, that's what they do. You plug it in, it always works. So I always call my username Toaster. And then eventually you just follow the bouncing ball, just keep pressing continue and watch the pretty slides. And eventually the machine will reboot and you'll have Grub, which is the Grand Unified Bootloader. And by default, it will load Linux within 10 seconds, or within that 10 seconds, you can cursor down here and choose to boot Windows. So if you do the default installation, you will end up with a dual boot system for Linux and Windows. And that's what I would recommend anybody does if you don't know what you're doing with Linux. Once you've decided that you want to try Linux using a live USB. So there we go. That's everything for now on Linux.
We have one question. Are there any UEFI problems with dual boot?
No. Linux is really mature now. Legacy BIOS type installations work fine, and UEFI works fine too.
Okay. I think that's all we had on there.
Right, thanks very much, Chris. So moving along, we have Bob Walker has another part on his privacy online segment. And tonight he's going to be talking about how to stop people tracking you and how to block ads and all the software you can use to do that.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, let me start the screen sharing here. Okay, and okay, we got the full screen there with the
yes, we do.
My splash screen there. Okay, great. Okay, so this week we're going to look at anti-tracking and ad blocker software. Like before, I'll be covering just the tip of the iceberg and pointing you towards where you can go for more information. That said, there's a lot of information on a lot of slides tonight, and I'm not going to speak to all the details and all the slides. You'll be able to download the deck afterwards if you want more information, and plus follow the links I'm going to give you to get even more information after that. Before we look at the actual ad blocker and anti-tracking tools, we'll have a quick look at some other strategies. There's the do not track setting that most browsers have. This was supposed to be an easy way to opt out of tracking, similar to the national do not call registry, which was supposed to be an easy way to opt out of telemarketing calls. And we all know how that worked. So there's no enforcement for do not track. And most of the companies that want to track you just ignore it. There's cookie management. You can delete all or specific cookies. You can have cookies delete at the end of the session. You can whitelist certain cookies to stay there. You can block third-party cookies, and these are usually tracking cookies. So that the browsers won't download them at all. You can configure your browser to limit tracking. And most browsers have settings that can limit the tracking. Some browsers offer more settings than others. And the privacy type browsers, which is now going to need to be Firefox, and then there's Brave and Safari, have better privacy protection than Google Chrome or Edge. And here are some links to go for to setting your browsers up. There's some differences between the various privacy tools, and here's a quick look at what VPNs will do. I'll have to get that cursor thing that Chris was talking about earlier. And The VPN will hide your location, prevent snooping on public Wi-Fi, and allow you to use geo-block websites. The ad blockers will stop targeted ads. Incognito mode will stop some targeted ads. And incognito mode usually clears your browser history and cookies when you exit it. And then there's the anti-tracking tools, which will do a lot more. Because this graph came from the good folks at Avast who make a product called AntiTrack, that sort of specifies their product, but it's about the same for any of them. There's an awful lot of overlap between configuring your browser, ad blocker tools, and anti-tracking tools. Some browser settings will block some ads. A lot of the anti-tracking tools include ad blocking capability, and some of the better ad blocker tools do quite a bit of anti-tracking. We've looked at the browser configuration, and so I have a quick look at the ad blockers. Just a note, in this presentation and on the other ones I've given, I've included details from various reviews. I've supplied the sources for these reviews with the URLs I've given. Many of the review sites are, and review type articles are sponsored by one or more of the companies being reviewed. So you need to look at several different reviews to get a complete picture of a product. The list of products in this presentation is by no means complete, and I don't list the products in any particular order of being the best or the worst or anything else. Okay, so ad blockers block random push ads from appearing on your screen. They don't actually block the ads. They block the requests that download the ads, and they prevent third-party vendors from downloading ads onto your browser. So even if you have the third-party cookies blocked, third-party sites can still get on to supply the ads. If you block the ads, it usually allows the web pages to load faster and you get a better experience. The benefits of ad blockers, they get rid of the unwanted ads. They improve page loading times. They restrict advertisements that can once they're loaded, can track you across various websites and platforms. It helps in the reduction of bandwidth usage, and they block fake advertisements, which can hide malware. The cons are some of the ad blockers may interfere with your online privacy, and that they themselves track your activity. The ad blockers mainly work by preventing scripts from loading, and this can prevent the page from loading correctly or cause the page to show incorrect data. And it may prevent you from enjoying content that doesn't support ad blockers. And we'll get to that in a second right here. A lot of websites rely on ad revenue to survive. So they're providing content, and the quid pro quo is that you'll view some of the ads and some of the link and use some of the links. Because of web blockers, these sites have lost almost $16 billion in the last few years. If you want to support your favorite websites, you can whitelist them on the ad blockers. And even if you don't click on the advertisements, many of the sites get the revenue from page views. So it still helps support your favorite sites. We'll look at some of the tools here. First we're going to look at is Total Ad Block. It filters out the usual pop-up and autoplay ads. Feature they have, some of the other ad blockers also include now, includes not just limiting the ads on YouTube, but stopping the ads that are in the middle of the video. And that really bugs me when you're watching a video on YouTube and you have to stop for a bit and watch an ad. They have versions for most Windows browsers and as well as versions for Android and iOS. Now keep in mind that the information that I just gave you was from a review of their paid version, Total Ad Block Premium, and it's not clear from the Total Ad Block site what stuff's included in their paid version versus their free version. But the paid version comes with a free copy of Total AV virus protection and their PC tune-up software. So AdBlock Plus is another popular ad blocker. They actually have an ad block browser as well. And for iOS, they have an ad block plus app. Now, AdBlock Plus has had criticism because when you set it up to whitelist various sites or ads from various sites, they get paid money to whitelist other companies. This is a little bit of a conflict of interest. Another one is AdBlock, and they're no relation to AdBlock Plus. They're probably one of the most popular, or probably is the most popular of the ad blockers. They work off a series of filter lists that automatically blocks ad content coming from known ad servers and providers. They have versions for Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and Edge. There's Popper Blocker, which is only for Chrome. There's FairStands Ad Blocker. Again, this is only for Chrome. There's Ad Blocker for YouTube. So this is specifically for use with YouTube. And it is supposed to stop the in video ads. And they have versions for Chrome and Firefox. There's AdGuard. Which starts to get into some of the anti-tracking tools as well. And now we're going to look at the anti-tracking tools that are specifically anti-tracking tools. So if you've set up your browser with the best settings and all that, and the ad blockers aren't quite doing what you want, you can get into an anti-tracking tool. And most of these anti-tracking tools also act as ad blockers. Depending on what site you look at for reviews, some of the tools are listed as anti-tracking tools, or some are listed as ad blockers. Some of these tools are browser extensions and are available depending on the browser you use. Others are standalone tools, and some of the standalone tools also add extensions into your browser. So there's a whole level of complexity here. And they have varying levels of configurability, ranging from you set and forget to ones that have a mind-boggling number of settings. I guess that depends on how easily your mind is boggled. The first one we're going to look at is DuckDuckGo Privacy Essentials. This is from the same folks that do the DuckDuckGo search engine and some other privacy products. Defending Digital, which is one of the top review sites, recommends this as their top recommendation because it has a good balance between power and simplicity. It blocks third-party trackers and shows a privacy grade for various websites. If you notice that it prevents a website from working properly, you can whitelist the site either just for that session or permanently. And they have versions for Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. Privacy Badger is one of the set and forget options. There's nothing to configure because it learns as it goes. As you browse the web, the same sources seem to be tracking your browser across different websites. Privacy Badger springs into action and tells your browser not to load any more content from that source. If it observes a third party host tracking on three separate sites, it will automatically disallow content from that tracker. And there's versions for Chrome, Firefox, and Opera. Ghostery is another blocker with fairly simple options. It also anonymizes your data and lets you customize the blocking. And you can block trackers in 8 different categories. I'm not going to get into listing them all here. You can also allow trackers from particular sites to load. And they have versions for Chrome, Firefox, Edge, Opera, and they have a ghostery light for Safari. UBlock Origin, this is the one to use if you're real techie and you want to get into all the details. You can put in a large number of filters, all sorts of other stuff. And it will also automatically block known malware sites. Note that this is not the same product as uBlock without the Origin name behind it. And there's versions for Chrome, Firefox, Edge, and Opera. Malwarebytes, who make all sorts of malware detection and antivirus products, they have a browser guard that stops unwanted and unsafe contact. It's the first browser extension that can identify and stop tech support scans. They, like all the others, they claim to speed up how fast pages display by blocking ads as part of the anti-tracking functions. And they have versions for Chrome, Firefox, and Edge. You sort of see a theme here that a lot of them, Chrome, Firefox, and Edge are the main browsers they speak to. Disconnect is one of the ones you can use it as a set and forget, or you can do a whole bunch of configurations. So it's sort of in the middle ground there. They have a visualizer page, which is unique. I wasn't able to get a screenshot of this in time for this presentation, but you can look at it there. And again, they have versions for Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and Opera. Now, the big anti-tracking tool is Avast Anti-Track Premium. This shields you against website tracking. And you can also set it to clean your browsing data periodically. It's a full anti-tracking tool, and it installs extension in some of the more popular browsers as part of the way it operates. It also feeds fake data to the trackers so they don't see your true digital fingerprint. It also deletes tracking cookies and any other tracking data. It claims to do all this without breaking sites, which can happen when with some of the other products. I use Avast Anti-Track Premium, and it hasn't broken any sites so far, but the Avast VPN does. You can, like most of the others, you can whitelist trustworthy sites, and you can restrict the installed applications that collect data about you. Some of the apps you have installed on your computer can actually collect data about you and send it home to mama. Avast AntiTrack is paid software, but you can try it risk-free for 30 days. And I'm not going to go into the pricing here because depending on the phases of the moon, the tides and all sorts of other things. Depends on what your price is, what your deal is. Do you get a package deal bundled with other Avast products? Do you get a single device license, or do you get a multi-device license that goes on? So you can go to the Avast site and get more information there. They have versions for Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Edge, Internet Explorer, and Opera. AVG AntiTrack, Avast bought out AVG a few years ago. So the AVG AntiTrack is basically a clone of Avast AntiTrack. Same parent company, same trial period, same features. The Norton AntiTrack also comes from Avast and AVG. It does have a free trial, and said it has a 60-day money-back guarantee. Here's a bunch of URLs to cover a lot of the information I just went through here. Includes much more detailed reviews of the products that I covered here, and includes a lot of products that I didn't cover here. As well, there's at the top, there's you can check your browser fingerprint at the Cover Your Tracks website there. And if you click on it in the deck, it'll take you to the site. And at the bottom, there's an interesting one, the four best and two worst ad blockers. So that's it for tonight. Next session, we'll look at the privacy policies of the internet giants and what is it they do with your information. Okay.
We have a question, and I'm not sure if you know the answer to in the chat. How does the ad blocker for YouTube work? So you're watching a video on YouTube and it stops the ad from loading, interrupting the video, question mark. I was wondering if ads were part of the videos. Hard to tell which YouTube videos have ads.
The video itself doesn't have the ad in it. The video is a separate file that plays. And what they do is the viewer for the file is YouTube, is the YouTube site. And what the site does is it stops the video partway through and plays the ad and then continues on with the video. So what the ad blocker does is it just keeps playing the video to you. I know this because there's another product I'm going to review one of these days for one of the sessions that allows you to it's a video downloader thing, and you can download YouTube videos to your computer, and so I'll cover that one of these days. But basically, I was annoyed by some of the ads in it in the YouTube videos, and I realized when I actually downloaded the video, it didn't have the ad in it. So that's how I sort of came across that information.
I guess by the same token, the same as you talked about with websites that have objections to ad blockers, that's where they get their revenue. Certainly YouTubers we'll be getting revenue similarly from ads that get presented. And so if you like getting free content, there is, you know, a thought that maybe watching the ads helps keep the platform available as a source of revenue for YouTubers.
Now, there's some of the sites that depend on the ad revenue. Can identify you're using an ad blocker and won't let you go to the site.
Yeah.
And it says, you know, we detected you're using an ad blocker. Please disable before going on to the site. And they just straight out don't let you go there. If you're not gonna pay for the product by looking at the ad, by letting the ads load, then we're not gonna let you use the site.
And I think that's fair enough. I mean, if people want to do that, I mean, they're the ones giving up the content. And so if they decide that, you know, they've detected you're blocking the ads, I don't object to that. If I get those pop up, I'll either move on or I'll disable the ad blocker if the content is important enough for me. But often I'll just move on to something else.
Yeah. I go to a lot of recipe websites because I'm a bit of a cook. And generally these sites support themselves by offering the ads, so they depend on that ad revenue to be in existence, because people aren't going to do all the work to run one of these sites for free.
Yeah.
And as annoying as some of the ads can be sometimes, you can always just ignore them and scroll through. The ads I don't like are the autoplay ones, and most of the ad blockers you can choose just to block those on certain sites. So.
Okay, I think that's all of the questions we had in the chat. So if anybody else has any other questions or comments or something, you can throw it into the chat or unmute yourself.
And thanks a lot, Bob. There's quite a few comments already saying they're really enjoying the content, so that's really good. Okay, so I have a few minutes left over for questions. If anybody has anything that they want to ask, we can take your questions now.
Tom is asking, Bob, could you present on good programs for following recipes on a tablet, phone, or PC sometime? So it's just a wish list for the future?
Generally, I just go to the recipe site, so I'll start out with, you know, recipes for Cornish game hens, for example, and I'll look at some of the ones that pop up. I'll go to some of the sites, I'll look at the recipe or recipes that make the most sense to me, and just copy and paste it into a Word document for later reference. So I don't have any apps or anything that do that. There's maybe four or five websites I go to that they send me emails every once in a while. Here are some of their latest recipes, and these are usually specialty sites like Japanese cooking or gluten-free cooking, because my wife is celiac and has to have gluten-free foods and stuff like that. But otherwise, I just do a search for a particular type of recipe and go for it from there.
Okay, I don't think I missed any questions in the chat, but if I did, please shout out and we can revisit it. Otherwise, I think we can have Alan run through the wrap-up slides, and then if we have any last questions, we can cover them after the wrap-up.
Yeah, Bob's thinking that that was a good thought, but he thought Bob should offer free samples too. Okay,
especially so those Cornish game hens. They're pretty fancy, Bob.
I got several good recipes for those.
So coming up next week will be the regular monthly meeting for the club. If anybody's interested in genealogy, then this is the meeting for you, because we have two members from the Ontario Genealogical Society, the Ottawa branch, who are going to be talking about getting started in genealogical research. And if anybody is not a member, or you know somebody who is thinking of joining the club, I remind everyone that we have a special 2-for-1 offer right now. And basically, if you buy a membership right now for $20, that's the regular annual fee, we're actually going to give you a second year of membership absolutely free. So you're buying one membership year, and we're going to give you two. So that's a deal not to be missed. But notice it's only available until the end of March, when our new calendar year starts, or the club year starts. Now, I also remind current members that you don't need to do anything, because your membership will be extended by a year automatically. The board has already made that decision. So if you are a member, you don't need to do anything. If you're not a member, and you have this wonderful opportunity to get 2 years for the price of one. And I remind you that because next week, February the 9th, is a regular meeting, and we will not have a Q&A session following that. So our next Q&A session will be in 2 weeks, on February the 16th. So that gives you lots of time to think about questions that you want to ask, and topics that you want to share, and it gives you lots of time to send Chris and I a heads up to suggestionbox@opcug.cn. And with that, I think we're right on the money at 8:30. I don't see any questions in the chat.
Nope.
So from me, thanks for attending and good night.
Thanks, folks. And we'll see you next week at the monthly meeting and in 2 weeks at the next Q&A. Great attendance again tonight.